kids, this is Bat Segundo, and I wish to clarify certain rumors that have gotten out of hand. For one thing, I have not abandoned the show. It was written into my contract that I was entitled to 2 weeks of vacation, or perhaps a little more. I'm not one of those shady pro-union freaks, but certainly you and I can agree that I'm entitled to a rest now and then. Anyway, I went to the sunny beaches of Maui to avoid the December cold, watching baby elephants mesh with ukuleles. It was a beautiful and strange sight. I left a carefully written note to Jorge and the producer informing them of my plans. I now understand that my note was intercepted, possibly confiscated by someone who worked for the NSA, without my permission, without a warrant or anything like that, which resulted in last week's little contretemps. But enough about me, because we've got quite a long show this week. I've told the young roving correspondent repeatedly that he's got to stop yapping, but it seems that he can't take a hint. Anyway, this week's guest is Mark Ames. Not related to Jonathan Ames, mind you, but not entirely without a sense of humor. He's written a book called Going Postal, which attempts to explain post office violence and work massacres over the past 30 years. Speaking for myself, I'm just far too relaxed right now to take Jorge out with a rather trivial act of violence. I'm also without a certain puissance or nautilus savoir faire. That's what shameful New Year's resolutions are all about, my dear listeners. Of course, if vacation policies weren't so rigid, we wouldn't exactly be in this pickle now, would we? Anyway, on with the interview.
Okay, so we are here with Mark Ames. Mark, how are you doing?
Just super, thank you.
Okay, the jet lag was kicking your ass, you were saying earlier.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Yeah, it's I passed out last night at 7. Actually, I slept through an interview with Calix in Berkeley. I
feel you're kidding.
So, yeah, the guy won't talk to me now. I just slept through it. Like, I was supposed to, I think he was probably saying, you know, at such and such time, Mark Ames with me. And I got, when I finally woke up, there were like 9 calls, and I don't think I'll be welcome back there anymore.
We'll prod you with a stick in the event.
I know, I need it. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, I wanted to sort of point to the timeliness of your book because I found actually a recent news story from WOAI, and it pointed to what reporters styled an online terror threat at a school. I'm not sure if you heard about this. It's in San Antonio.
It's not the only online terror threat that's happened, but I'm not surprised.
Well,
so yeah.
This one was the big thing because they apparently were saying a school administrator named Pasquale Gonzalez said, "It just seems to me that if you put up a public website and you allow students, teenagers, minors to post their thoughts and ideas and not monitor it in an adult manner, you are asking for trouble. It just seems to me that the owners of MySpace.com should be held accountable." MySpace was where these came from. And again, it's sort of, again, a similar sort of case of pointing fingers to the problem.
Yeah, I've just started hearing about MySpace, but I mean, what happened is they're hearing what kids are actually thinking and dreaming about, and they don't want to hear it, and they figure if we don't hear it, it won't happen. It's the usual, you know, head in the sand theory. But they've gone actually much farther than that. I mean, kids have posted harmless things on the internet and had their lives destroyed. Like one kid I know, he got sort of humiliated in front of his class out here in Walnut Creek. So he posted this, some kind of jokey thing about, I don't know, pissing on his teacher's body or something like that, but it was on his own website, yeah, and they waited till the kid was in school, and then the cops stormed into his classroom. You know, this is like Walnut Creek, nice white middle class area. He stormed into his classroom and frog marched him out to the quad, and I'm sure his life's destroyed. I mean, the kid's going to be a little Charlie Manson now, you know, over some stupid joke over that, and so, yeah, I think they just don't want to hear kids' thoughts, that's all.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to sort of go into the sort of the research of your book, and it sort of was struck me as, and it goes back to this question of language. It was a little bit interestingly idiosyncratic in the way that you used excerpts from the internet and emails to sort of allow the language to sort of stand alone. And that's the kind of focus I don't normally see in one of these sorts of nonfiction books. I was wondering, though, the sense I got was that do you believe language to be sort of responsible as a form of enslavement?
Huh. No, I don't. I think, I guess I'm a little I'm actually a former rhetoric major, right? And people got a little hung up on how powerful language was. I think actually the slavery comes from the more obvious things, which is the socioeconomic system and so on.
The language, slavery.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that it does play a part, but let me back up though.
Yeah.
The reason why, I didn't intend to write the book that way, but as I was writing it, for me it was kind of, this crime was sort of for me like a filter to look, to get a snapshot, I guess, of America right now, as almost a semi-foreigner. I mean, I'm kind of like a semi-foreigner in a way, right? And so all these voices, all these things, emails and so on, that a lot of people, Amazon.com reviews or whatever, that I think most people live in deep inside the culture would dismiss as obvious and wouldn't even pay attention to because it's so around, it's so obvious. For me, it was mind-blowing. I mean, really incredibly grotesque and funny and horrible and mind-blowing. And that's why I put a lot of that in. I don't know. I find it fascinating. And I think, some other people I was showing this stuff to also found it fascinating. You just had to put it into the right context, I think.
Yeah. Well, specifically, just so for people who have not read the book here, we're talking about like the parallels in language and clauses from slavery to...
talking about that. I'm talking about...
There's also that aspect, too, of just right. Like quoting the Amazon reviews. Of
well, you have to... You have. To, I mean, you see, my thesis in the book that rage murders are modern-day slave rebellions and that there are parallels between the conditions people are in today and slavery. It's on the one hand, it's an incredibly obvious, I think, thesis. But on the other hand, it's really difficult for people to accept. And that's why I think if you find evidence like that in the language, the language that people use, then it really shocks people awake. And then they can't sort of squirm their way out of it as easily. That's why, for example, you look at slave management theory, and it is shockingly, absolutely word for word similar to modern management theory. In fact, in some ways, it's more humane. It is actually more humane, because post-Reagan era management theory is all about fear, and even slave management theory did not emphasize fear as much. They emphasized trying to make the slave see his interests and his master's interests as one and the same. They tried to make the slave a morally upstanding and cheerful person, It's more like it's pretty shocking to read it. I think what you realize from that, though, is that what you realize from the similarity in the language is that some things like slavery are not, it's not so totally alien, It is just a normal thing at its time. It was an absolutely normal thing until... through the thousands of years until this one point in history where suddenly it was people woke up and realized it was horrible. And a lot of what my book is about is trying to look back at where we're at today, trying to look back as if we're kind of outside of our time or 100 years from now, because there are always things that you can't see in your time that are really horrible and unjust. That we put up with because it seems normal.
Well, speaking of being outside, you are an expatriate living predominantly in Russia. Did you feel that sort of allowed you to examine the problem more effectively?
Absolutely. Or? Living in Russia, before I came to Russia, that whatever anger and hatred and alienation, whatever that I felt, it was a lot more difficult to put into words, or I'd have to frame it in somebody else's version, probably like from the 60s or something like that. And when you live outside the culture, again, things that seem too obvious suddenly take on a lot more significance. You can see the obvious things, the damage that they do a lot better. Being away, I think it's helped a lot of people. I mean, Hunter Thompson, he lived outside of the country for a few years, and I have a feeling that really helped him see through things a lot as well.
George Orwell, too.
Yeah, I mean, a lot, Orwell and, Hemingway and so on. I'm not huge fans of theirs, but it does help because, again, when you're too deep inside of a culture, you just can't see you dismiss the obvious things that shouldn't be dismissed.
Well, one of the interesting things, the recurring themes throughout this book, is the sort of the stigma or the red flags against sort of behavior that is considered weird or strange, and the homogenizing sort of standards towards deportment and the like. And the suggestion here is that people are sort of likely to snap when placed under certain sort of conditions in which they must conform. However, if I were to play the devil's advocate here, then if the majority of people were likely to conform, then what interest does society have to preserve the minority of sort of bohemians or the riffraff who won't stick to the hard line?
I wouldn't say people are likely to snap if they're forced to conform. I think they're likely to snap as they have been if they're put in horrible, unbearable conditions, particularly when those conditions aren't even contextualized yet, as we have right now. I mean, these rage murders happen, and they still are. They still lack a context. And I think one of the main goals of this book is to give it a context. These people. That's why it seems like they're snapping at random. These are all conformist people for the most part. I mean, some of them weren't, like, you know, like the Columbine killers, for example. But for the most part, all these corporate people and so on who snap, they're totally conformist. They're just squeezed to death, and they're people who, okay, the kind of person who snaps, though, is the kind of person who we would consider, you know, not totally balanced. But I mean, these people existed in the 40s and 50s and 60s. They weren't snapping then because the squeeze wasn't as horrible, and the disconnect between where we were supposed to be in our lives and our propaganda and where we're actually at wasn't as wide, I don't think. But I don't think it has to do with conformism. I think it has to do with, you know, actually having lives destroyed. These guys snap when their lives are destroyed and they have nowhere else to go. They think they're dead or worse than dead.
But at the same time, judging by the examples on your book, you have Eric and Dylan snapping because they're misunderstood and they're called fags, etc.
Weren't nonconformists. They were tortured. I mean, they were abused to... incredibly abused, and the whole school, again, it isn't even just that they're abused, that's one thing, and that's bad enough, but the school culture tolerated it and considered that normal and good and rewarded the people who did that. Mm-hmm. And at some point, how can you not hate the school and the culture and the larger country that promotes the jock assholes that, you know, that I mean, I don't think it's, there are a lot of nonconformists that never snap because actually I think particularly in modern America, there's a whole sort of like segment for them to go in. Like goths, for example, they never snap. They talk about it a lot, but real goths never snap, you know, because they have their own,
but they
own
have a
kind of
culture,
world.
Though,
yeah,
at
exactly.
At the same time, a lot of the people here who can't find other people in their subculture are largely lonely, solitary, and as a result, they have no one to sort of reach out. And this is sort of, it's because society or the dictates of, say, the office world or even the school world suggest that they are strange or weird. I mean, this is now the qualifier. And I guess what I'm suggesting here is what can society do to sort of recognize them or reach out to people who are, you know, who might be considered weird? And how do we define weird? I mean, you know, it's subjective entirely.
You know, basically you'd have to put a Stalin in charge of this country for about 20 years to clean things up, which wouldn't be a bad thing. But I talked about the sort of destructive effects of how weird, as particularly in a modern adult world epithet. It's pretty much like calling in high school, you know, somebody gaylord or fag or whatever. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think that the changes need, it's not so much about reaching out, you know, and hug your local potential rage murder. I don't think there's any way really to stop it short of some huge sort of socio-economic earthquake, kind of like a Great Depression, which completely transforms our society again, the way that did. I mean, after the Great Depression, for example, you know, corporations made it explicit that they thought their job was not just to maximize shareholder profits, but also to take care of their employees, who were loyal to them, and take care of them, you know, up until they died, basically. And you know, and now that doesn't exist anymore, and people are squeezed to death. And how do you change that? I mean, that's what I think. Those are the kind of things that need to be changed. I don't really, you know, I don't know how you change it, but I think first of all, we have to sort of recognize that what we think is normal and what's going on right now is is objectively horrible and will be seen that way in the future when people look back and say, how the hell did you, why did you guys put up with that?
Well, there is still potential for compassion and empathy. I mean, 9/11, the number of people who volunteered, the number of people, the corporations who put in money, same thing with Katrina, where, you know, even in light of a complete government fuck up, you still had this amazing sort of amount of funds go into the Red Cross, even though they weren't able to be allocated.
Sure, there are all kinds of nice people everywhere, but you know, there are also a lot of people there. I mean, we also decided to kill tons of people because of 9/11 who are completely innocent, right? Yeah. I mean, we're a really mean country.
Yeah.
We can do compassionate things that, so long as our compassion is constantly recognized and we get rewarded with smiles and tears for it, but it's never a selfless compassion. And we do a lot of really horrible things with an absolutely clean conscience all around the world because our intentions are always good.
What I'm suggesting, though, is the American people versus the American government. There's a major distinction between the actions of an American civilian who sees the terrible sort of shit that happened in New Orleans and goes ahead and either volunteers their time or their money to Red Cross,
sure,
versus a government, you know, that just completely, like, is completely incompetent and takes 2 weeks to actually react before going and producing, you know, actually creating aid.
Yeah, of course. There are all kinds of nice people. I'm not really sure how that quite fits in to my book. I mean, I'm sure there are all kinds of very nice slaves, and actually very nice most slave owners were nice people and very morally upstanding and consider themselves morally upstanding people and consider what they were doing to be a morally good thing. You know, the fact that there's niceness everywhere and compassion, there's always been that. I don't think it really says anything about, you know,
I'm suggesting, though, that there is some sort of element that it might exist to counter rage murders, and that might actually work towards reaching out to other people that might, you know, feel isolated or lonely enough to actually go ahead and blow, you know, blow the hell out of the
school. In individual cases, I'm sure that might happen, yeah. But I don't, I think the culture, the way it's gone since Reagan took power, the general direction of the culture is rewarding mean, rich people as a general rule. And if you're compassionate but sort of in the middle or a failure or something, you're a loser. And the culture doesn't really reward them. I mean, and that goes down several levels. I mean, the idea that people come home from work and watch The Apprentice and watch more stress and somebody getting fired by a jerk boss, you know, I find that to be one of the sickest things I've ever seen.
Yeah. Well, I do too. But at the same time, it's like, what if people are content doing that? What if they're content to sort of talk about their
They're
Walmart
wrong
purchases?
To be content. You know, I mean, they're wrong. They're wrong. They're wrong about a lot of things 200 years ago, and they're wrong about that now.
Even if they're perfectly happy, they may have like family or kids that they like. They may actually enjoy suburbia. I mean, you or I may not enjoy that, but if they are happy, what is necessarily wrong with that?
Well, I mean, again, this is getting away from my book, but yeah. If you want to, what's wrong with it? You know, nothing's wrong. I want to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. But if you want to link things up,
yeah.
What's wrong with it is what's wrong with a slave owner being happy? He was very happy, and the people and his family were happy. In fact, Nat Turner, the slave rebel, you know, the family that he killed that took care of him, after when he was interrogated, he said he had absolutely nothing against them. They're nice people. They treated him well. And Matt Turner himself was a bit sick. He was a bit of a schizophrenic. But do we look at him? We look at what he did, and we think it was justified. And these poor people that he killed, these white families and some of the others that he killed, I mean, they were, at that time, they were just happy, morally upstanding, decent people. If what this is about is just happiness, then, I mean, maybe I shouldn't write books like this, but if you're trying to diagnose a sickness, you know, or a problem in the culture, you know, that's what you got to focus on.
What I'm suggesting, though, is like...
I know what you're suggesting, like, maybe if everybody would...
I'm not suggesting free to be you and me or anything like that, but, I mean, I am suggesting that while I actually did enjoy the argument in your book, that there is indeed another side of the coin in terms of the fact that some people are perfectly content to have nothing more than the sort of, you know, this existence, and are not going to necessarily go ahead and blow up at all.
Most people don't. And again, happiness, I mean, I agree with that. And they're even content with a situation that I think is objectively horrible. I mean, again, you know, to make another analogy, a lot of slaves were happy, you know, and not just black slaves in America, but white slaves in North Africa and West Africa. I mean, happiness is, what is it? It's a biochemical state, I suppose.
A warm gun.
Yeah. Well, that's another kind of happiness. part of what I write about in the book is that it is actually normal for, okay, this is more of a kind of a sociobiological issue or some zoological issue, but I think it's normal for human beings to take and to become content with whatever horrible situation they're in, or good situation or horrible situation, right? And it's actually, it generally takes a sick person to rebel against something, even when the situation is horrible. I mean, most of there are very few slave rebellions in America, less than a dozen, probably 6 to 9. And Nat Turner is the one we know most about, and he was a schizophrenic. John Brown was clearly insane also, but we look at what he did as something, the only sane thing possible. It was the only sane thing, right? But all the people who were content and happy were totally insane. I mean, that they put up with that. So I don't know, content, happy people who put up with this are, I mean, they're slaves. But that makes them bad people, makes them normal.
It makes them willing, happy slaves versus, you're suggesting you, I mean, obviously, clearly you sympathize with the unhappy slave, then. Would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think most people do. today we do, yeah. Most people sympathize. In fact, we don't even want to hear about the fact that most slaves led normal, dull, banal lives with their routine and got even paid a bit of money and went into town and, you know, all that kind of stuff. We don't really want to hear about that. We just want to hear about the unhappy ones now, because that gives us a heroic sort of script to view the whole thing with. But at the same time, we don't really want to hear about miserable people enduring what we think is normal today. So we think there's something wrong with them, and when they snap, it's funny, or they're evil, or they were into Hitler or whatever. But again, I think I don't even think it'll be 100 years. I think 20, 30 years. People will look back at this time and the way people rolled over and let the plutocrats, whatever you want to call them, really take everything from the middle class and the lower middle class and the middle class and even sort of the upper middle class and just take everything and just rolled over and took it. I think people will look back and just think, what was wrong with you guys? You know, you're weird. And they'll think that people who struck back, it made a lot more sense. They may not like them as much as we like John Brown and Nat Turner, but they'll think at least it made sense.
Well, I will get back to the book. I got off a little tangent here, but...
No more about the hugging and all that.
Okay. no more hugging. You take Kathy Bennett to task for being a snitch against Al de Guzman in the 2001 almost aborted bombing of De Anza Community College, and you also rail against employees within an office who are likely to report or inform their human resources supervisor for strange behavior and various other employees. And the suggestion here I get is that being a fake is the thing to be in American culture. Is that correct? Or?
Absolutely. I think people love being snitches, love being in with power and authority against some individual who may be weird or suspicious. In fact, I think people desperately want that. You know, it's like this whole Amber Alert thing. I mean, people desperately want to believe that there is a danger out there, and they're collaborating with the healthy, normal people in suppressing these dangers when they arise. And but the sad, horrible thing is, what if, like, the sad thing is that most people aren't being stalked. Most people don't have a potential rage murder in their school or office, you know, because most people just sort of take it and but in the case of this girl, I mean, she did, objectively, she did the right thing, right, by turning in Al de Guzman. He clearly wanted to be caught, too, otherwise he wouldn't have handed that in. But the idea that she was then, living in Russia makes you very wary of these things. The idea that she was turned into a heroine, I mean, even in Russia they wouldn't do that anymore. Turning a fink into a heroine, it's just insane. But here is completely normal. People loved her for being a fink and then started promoting all these different snitch programs. And obviously what happens in these snitch programs is that they're always going to go after, I mean, they're never going to get the right person, right? Or only one in 100 times they're going to get the right. They're just going to get the person who stands out for not seeming normal. So that person is already screwed once over for not sort of seeming normal or cool enough. And he's going to get screwed over a second time because he's now a suspect for not being normal or cool enough, you know?
Well, simultaneously, though, there's considerable scorn against, oh, say, Linda Tripp or Judith Miller recently, who are both might be considered snitches, but there's a specific type of snitch. Why do you think that is? That people are willing to sort of like, you know, oh, these are clearly finks, these are snitches, these are, you know, Benedict Arnolds, but yet at the same time they celebrate a specific sort of criminal kind of snitch.
Yeah, well, I mean, with Laura Tripp and Judith Miller, I mean, there's only a certain type of person that really hates them, right? And it's all tied up into politics. I mean, the people that hate Laura Tripp are the people that hate Bill, that like Bill Clinton for the most part. And also, she's just a disgusting human being. she's, you know, physically, morally, everything. She's just a disgusting human being. It's pretty easy to hate her. But I think Judith Miller, what they hate about her is that she collaborated with the authorities and lied to help support, you know, an evil war. That's why she's hated. I don't think it's a snitch thing so much.
Well, it's sort of a snitch thing and like, okay, I'm going to go to jail for these values and then I'm going to go ahead and turn it over. It's sort of like, how much of it is opportunity?
I thought she was, I have to admit, I'm a little bit out of that, but I thought she was actually, by kind of, I was asking different people because I know what the left's version of that is, and I agree with the left on that, but what I thought was the average Americans thought she was a free speech hero. I mean, I asked sort of average Americans, they all thought, no, the basic story is she's a free speech hero for going to jail and was never considered.
I don't know. I mean, I live here in San Francisco.
Yeah, you're here in San Francisco. So I'm talking about, I asked people outside of that world, and that was the way the story was being spun in middle America, as the way it seemed, as the way it was spun in Russia, you know, where people are a bit more ignorant about the details. She's a free speech martyr. That's it. You know, people don't get that deep into these stories. So, well, Linda Tripp was just, was disgusting on every level. I think. Sorry, I'm spitting there.
Oh, no problem. I spit myself several times when I first heard the Linda Tripp story. another interesting thing you point out in this book, to sort of go along, is that people, you point out, accepted the inner city riots of the 1960s and the 70s because they were lower class and there was some sort of historical context. There was a framework. And yet,
at first there wasn't, though. It took a while before there was a framework set up. I mean, again, no, it took a while. And it was only through violence that a framework to understand what was happening developed, right? That probably even the people who were writing didn't exactly know it. You know, it sort of reminds me of the anti-globalization thing. I remember for the first 5-10 years, maybe even, of the movement, after Seattle even, so on, people just thought, really, I mean, even people I went to Berkeley with who kind of changed them said, you know, these people don't even know what they're doing, what they're arguing against, because it really it wasn't in the popular conscience yet. And then people suddenly start, you know, through violence and through mass action, people, a frame develops for larger people to sort of fit what's happening into. But no, the riots, they were without a frame at first. And I think I quoted there was a commission, a congressional commission, or a report from 1967 about riots in Cincinnati. I'm sorry, this commission quoted another report when there were riots in Cincinnati. And for example, there the people from the city council, they just didn't understand why they're having riots. So they couldn't understand it at all. And yet every single person in the city council was white. There were a few middle-class blacks sort of sprinkled around in a largely black city. They really thought they were doing so much good for these people, and that they just couldn't understand it. And you see that over and over. I mean, when the colonists rioted against the Stamp Act, Parliament literally did not even understand what was going on. Parliament in England didn't even understand it just made zero sense at all. And again, when there were early slave rebellions also, it made zero sense to people. There was no context to put it within. Why would slaves rebel? We're doing these people a favor, and everybody, slavery everywhere. They just couldn't understand it.
Yeah. But these days we have the, as you pointed out, the let's move on sort of attitude, which I was amused by, actually, and the zero tolerance policies. You pin the blame largely on, obviously, Reagan-era policies, but I'm wondering what historical context can be invented to get people aware, like they were, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, of inner-city riots, so that they actually view the middle-class sort of massacres as something that is, you know, that we should think about and we should reform or we should accept and we should do something.
I think we're a long way away, because in the first place, the middle class is a strange class. It doesn't have, not only does it not really have a class consciousness, particularly in the sense of like some kind of repression or something, but it actually, it despises the very idea of that, and it's constantly belittling. Like, for example, if people are, you know, suffering from a really cruel corporate culture, or whatever, and they complain, they're called whiners, or the kids are complaining from just, you know, really horrible school culture. They're just called whiners. Now, you know, in lower classes, they don't call themselves whiners so much, or like a kid in an inner city school who's feeling so much pressure he's going to shoot somebody or something. He's not called a whiner.
Yeah.
You look at his conditions and say, so I think we're actually really, really far from that, because basically this is a very subversive type of crime or uprising, because, you know, at least the lower class problems or black problems or whatever, it's still confined to a minority, a part of the population that doesn't define America, but white middle class middle America, that defines America. So if that's what's causing people to turn to violence, it's basically saying this whole country is completely screwed up right now. It's
white male entitlement.
But again, also remember, a lot of these, it's not just a white male thing. I mean, there are African Americans and Asian Americans, women, so on, who've all done these crimes. So really, it starts with violence. I mean, that's just a sad fact. And a lot of it. And I don't think there have been enough of these yet. Well, yeah, I don't think there have been quite enough of these. Sometimes it works. I mean, I wrote about this when Andy Williams in Santee, after his shooting, suddenly bullying in schools was no longer considered that acceptable. It was no longer acceptable to say, hey, you know, this is just part of life, get over it, deal with it, and so on. Now it's recognized as a real problem that destroys people. But even just 2 years before that, when people talked about the bullying that the Columbine killers put up with, they were just called whiners. And I think I quoted an article in Time magazine by Nancy Gibbs, I believe her name is. She was completely belittling the idea that bullying is a bad thing. In fact, she strongly implied that it was the only way to sort of grow up was to go through bullying. And all studies show that bullying only destroys people. That's it. You know, there's nothing good about it at all.
At the same time, though, let's just say, for the sake of, again, playing the devil's advocate here, that we were to suddenly permit every sort of grievance and complaint and bitching and all that sort of things, or whining, or what's considered that kind of thing, if education or offices were to allow that, then how do you, with all the sort of floodgate of complaints, how then can these two...
Yeah, but my book isn't really about, I mean, they're already not tolerating bullying. Bullying now, just to take bullying, I think that's a small part of the problem. I don't think that's a big part. It's just, yeah, it's a symptom of something else that's bigger, yeah, right? And bullying is already not tolerated the same way that sexual harassment was viewed up until, you know, 20, 30 years ago. It's just a part of normal life. And people, yeah, women who can't deal with it, they're just not strong enough and they got to deal with the real world, blah, blah, blah. You know, and we already don't look at it that way. But again, the bigger problem isn't grievances, individuals' grievances in the social situations. The bigger problem is, I mean, again, just to cite one statistic, CEOs of major corporations in 1978 made, on average, 30 times their average employee's wage. And in 2001, They made over 500 times their average employee's wage. Not even talking about all the benefits that have been slashed that used to exist. That is an unbelievable statistic. It's as obvious as anything could possibly be obvious that there's been a massive transfer of wealth and everything else, you know, from a larger pool to a very, very small pool. And that's where you start. And then on top of that, you know, people work unbelievable hours and get treated like crap and fired at will and by the tens of thousands. And then, so you really got to start from there. And in the same way that that the rage murder phenomenon started in the adult world and then eventually 10, 12 years filtered down to the kid world, you know, I think to change things, you need to change the sort of superstructural thing at the adult world. Eventually that would filter down. But I don't see any will for that. I think Americans are strange people. They actually, Americans, it's a very Protestant thing. They love, the you know, it's like Lenin said, the worse the better. I think your average American really likes to be overworked, overstressed.
Well, you also write in the book, the Ward Cleaver line, if Ward Cleaver were alive today, he'd rarely be home to see his wife, children, and when home, he'd be an impossible crank, almost getting called on the cell phone and buzzed on the BlackBerry. At the same time, though, that using Ward Cleaver, though, is a bit of a fictionalized ideal. But you do point out in your book that the fictionalized ideal has actually changed throughout films, for example.
Right.
Is perhaps, like, you know, creating some sort of, like, identifying sort of ideal. I mean, for example, the popularity of the film Office Space. It's unbelievable. They just released a new edition.
Yeah.
And it's still...
Thank God, because it's one of the greatest movies.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. But it's interesting that people identify with that, but at the same time, does that actually contribute to them actually either thinking about the system that exists? How does a film action or even a work like yours actually get people thinking about the change, thinking about sort of like, you know, reforming a system and actually allowing this sort of like seemingly impossible Sisyphean task to actually occur, you know?
Yeah, propaganda takes a long time. Cultural propaganda, which my book is, which Office Space is, which Fight Club is, and all. I think it takes a long time to filter down and filter into other areas of thought, which then transform into actual like policy change or so on. So, but it's definitely a start. First, you have to raise people's consciousness that what's going on is not normal. That if they feel like things are wrong and bad, that they are actually not insane. That they're actually totally sane.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not easy. I think a huge part of making the change happen is making people aware that this injustice or this intolerable situation even exists. And so in that sense, I mean, I think we're moving forward a lot. But again, I actually think you're right. It's a huge task, you know. I mean, when you think about what unionizers went through, or what, you know, what Africans American went through, you know, these things can take 100 years to
But
to
they
change.
Also could also take, I mean, like the Fast Food Nation supersize me thing kind of changed things a little bit.
A little bit, but that's like a palliative. I mean, it's you know, it's like giving tea breaks to slaves or something, like an index. I mean, there's still McDonald's everywhere, and then people are still obese and dying, and the food we're served is still completely destroyed by these fast food companies. They just, you know, they cleverly staved off a larger rebellion by taking a little steam off, you know, by not having supersized things. That's it.
Yeah.
And one journalist got rich off that, or two journalists got rich, and that's it.
And now Richard Linklater is about to get rich off of that.
Oh, yeah? Well, he's already rich, I'm sure. But that's why his name is Rich.
Well, I guess, though, I mean, at the same time, okay, I was, first of all,
you're basically looking for some kind of, you know, which I don't like this. You're looking for some kind of something constructive, right? Like, okay, so you're exposing it and you're bringing this out, but how do we change it?
How do you also prevent this from being sort of a preaching to the converted kind of thing? How do you actually reach out?
I don't think anybody is converted on this. I don't think anybody, I mean, even my best friends weren't when I first showed them my initial ideas on this. Nobody's converted on the idea that modern rage murders are sort of updated slave rebellions. Nobody is. So I'm not too worried about that. In fact, I find a lot of resistance in my, among some readers, I find a lot of resistance from people on the left to a lot of what I write about in the book.
Are you familiar with, there's this book James Howard Kunstler wrote called The Long Emergency. Are you familiar with
this? The Long what?
The Long Emergency.
No, what is it?
It's actually, your book reminded me of the Kunstler book, but basically he basically takes America to task for basically surviving on all this oil and living in a sort of suburban kind of city structure that is going to completely collapse once the oil collapse and Hubbard's Peaks happens, and then as a result, all people will. He claims, and he makes actually a pretty interesting argument that within 50 years, America will sort of, if we continue at this particular pace of suburban development and oil consumption, then in 50 years we'll become this agrarian society. And
it's very wishful thinking. Yeah, it's very, very wishful thinking. Yeah. I mean, predicting the collapse of X has always been a bad business, you know. That's why I kind of try and stay away from that. I mean, America's been declared on the verge of collapse or eclipse so many times. And, you know, I think it's going to happen now. I mean, but I'm not going to say that because who the hell knows?
Is this why you may have hesitated from conclusions towards the end? Because you did obviously sort of, you asked Americans, why are you letting yourself be sort of, not have any kind of pride being rolled over, essentially. Yeah. But there were no actual conclusions in terms of what
again,
could be
I think
done.
that's just it's a reader expectation that I just reject. You know, that if you expose a problem, that then you should therefore prescribe solutions to the problem, as if the two somehow go together, or as if exposing the problem isn't actually the biggest part of coming up with a solution, or as if there is a solution. Like, Americans are very problem-solving oriented, right? And I've kind of opted out of that paradigm. I just opted out of that paradigm, so I'm just not going to address it that way. Yeah, I should check my car.
Okay.
Do you mind?
Yeah, no
take
problem.
A little break. Have you ever read our magazine?
I've only through the web.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen Limonov's stuff at all. He writes in really bad, broken English. Uh-huh. You know what I'm talking about? Or no,
I didn't know. Unfortunately, I don't. I will look this in.
Okay. Limonov is, he was a writer. He was a famous emigre writer, more famous in Europe than here. He didn't do that well here. So he moved to France and became huge in Europe as this sort of, like the kind of, I don't know, the Bukowski or Jean Genet or something like that, of which Russian emigre literature was mostly anti-Soviet stuff. And his attitude, the reason why he didn't make it here in the 70s, because he said that America was no different from the Soviet Union. And so he kind of went nowhere. And in France, of course, they love to hear that. So he had huge in France.
Yeah.
And then in the early 90s, he, as the Soviet Union collapsed, he became, which isn't a surprise, he was always very radical. He became a Slavic nationalist. He went and fought with the Serbs in Bosnia and Croatia, and so the French after that basically threw him out of the country. And he joined up with Zhirinovsky's party for a while, and then started up his own party, the National Bolshevik Party. And he's still running it. And today, Limonov in Russia is the most famous writer alive in Russia right now. And he writes for my newspaper, because we started with him years ago when he was a real outcast still. And he's always been very punk, you know? I mean, he was into the punk scene and so on when he was younger. And he insisted on writing in bad, broken English to be as anti-literary as possible. People get so angry, I can't tell you. People
really?
They think it's a joke that I invented, or they can't believe it's happening.
They accepted in Jonathan Safran Foer.
What's that?
They accept broken English in Jonathan Safran Foer.
I mean, and his stuff is... Yeah, in Russia, he's mostly a very hated person, but he's huge. He's now literally the leader. The National Bolsheviks are the largest opposition party
really?
In Russia right now. They're huge. They have thousands of people. They do things, you know, like, I mean, they have 60 kids in jail from the party, you know,
wow.
Political prisoners. I mean, it's really huge.
Wow.
And he still writes for us about ridiculous things. Like, I'm going to have him write a piece next issue about, he spent time in jail, too. He was accused by the Russian government of acquiring weapons and trying to raise an army to invade Kazakhstan, and he spent 2.5 years in jail and just got out a couple of years ago.
Wow.
And he's going to write a piece for me next issue about, you know, there's a Napoleon pastry for Napoleon, and there's beef Wellington, so what would be his food item that he'd be remembered? And he's all excited, he's able to do that in a shitty English, you know. But actually, I was thinking a bit about what you've been asking me to try and be a little more fair. Getting back to my point, I think this guy, I think it was him out there.
Yeah.
He gave me a Lemonov book. I hadn't really heard of him before. It's this book called Memoir of a Russian Punk. It's the English title.
Yeah.
And it's a great book. It's just pure muscle, no fat in it at all. It's about a weekend in Kharkov, which is in Ukraine, of some 15-year-old ne'er-do-well who's just he's stealing money. He's trying to, like, get enough money to screw a girl that he's after who's really beautiful but is cheating on him and stuff. And, you know, what made the book so great is the first Soviet-era book I ever read that had, it was just about life. It had nothing to do with this horrible, evil state. And I think that's really how life was, particularly after Stalin. Most people, it was just, you know, it's pretty much probably kind of similar to now. It's just the Russians don't really, I mean, people didn't walk around and have KGB spooks scaring them, and they couldn't have freedom there. You know, they lived normal lives, and young kids were out stealing stuff, vandalizing stuff, and trying to, like, get laid and listening to rock and so on. And that's what the book was about. It's a great book. And he told me, he came up to me with the book, he said, man, he's this beatnik language, I'm really down with the street, but this book was too much for me, but I know your taste, you'll like, so he gave me the book. And after that, I had to meet Lemonov, but I don't know if I should go up to him and see if it's him. I can't even remember his name. But also about Lemonov, made me think about something else, you know, about coming up with solutions or something like that, which is what you're looking for. The problem is actually it's a very simple problem. It's a very old problem. And that problem is just, massive inequalities, right? There are few people who are taking everything and taking more and more and more from a huge amount of people who are generally doing nothing about it. And that's kind of, it's happened a lot in history. And it's the same thing with slavery, and it's the same thing with what happened to the working class until they fought for their rights and so on. You know, we like to try and come up with absolutely new paradigms and new things. It's actually an old problem. And, what's different about it, I think, are the expectations and what we believe about ourselves and what we believe our world is like. I mean, slaves for thousands of years mostly took it or rebelled, not against slavery as an institution, but just to get free, right? Until it was seen as something larger in it. Peasants, the same thing. You mostly took it and accepted it, thought it was reality. So I think, what's different now is our expectations. We actually think we're living in a really, really fair, just society and there's some fair, free-hand market which is dictating the way things have been going, and we're actually moving towards maximum efficiency, which eventually benefits everybody, and so on and so forth.
I should pull out Milton Friedman for you to sort of tear down.
I mean, I think your average schmuck believes that, though, right? Because because the propaganda since Reagan took power has eventually, it really has moved left-wing liberal ideas and propaganda really out to the margins. It's just the center of this country is very far to the right, really is. And it's going to take a while, I think, for the suckers to, and all the suckers think it's in their interest to think this way. And it's going to take a while for the suckers to wake up. So I don't know what, I'm not into predicting. But that also touches on the idea of ideology. I remember talking to Lemonov about ideology, because he runs a party called the National Bolshevik Party.
Yeah.
Right, you can imagine they're not like, they're not the Green Party. Actually, they're more like the Green Party. They're definitely not the Democrats. You know, they're not Clintonites or whatever. National Bolsheviks, they have elements of Bolshevism, a very radical elements of sort of 20s-style fascism. And it was started by Lemonov and this guy, sort of one of the big thinkers in Russia, a very radical thinker who's now part of sort of Putin's general world. Lemonov and him split. And Lemonov said, about ideology, when you sit down and sort of write it up or think about it, he said, again, there's actually, you're not going to come up with something new that is going to blow people's mind. And if you read the National Bolsheviks pamphlet, it's simple old stuff. You know, you're against a few things, you're for a few things. Like, we live in this culture where we constantly expect to have some revolutionary thing blow us away, when in fact, I think stuff
thing.
Is a lot more.
If you look at, like, the Black Panther platform too, similar sort of situation. It's actually very, very common sort of left.
It's almost disappointing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yet, And so it's actually some kind of a educated bourgeois expectation of an ideology because of what we're taught in universities about originality and things like that. But actually, it's everything, again, is a lot more simple. People are being totally shafted, and they're buying into it, and they're suckers. They're working against themselves, right? And they're loving it. Like, and so I think, you know, hopefully my book, to some little degree, is, you know, or Office Space or Fight Club, or these things, they start to wake people up. They don't give a solution, but I think that's such a small part of the whole thing.
Well, you do have that resignation notice email, which was laugh out loud hysterical for me anyway.
What did I say? I don't know.
The one where he says he's become a trophy, he's accepted the position as a trophy husband. And
that was good.
That was good. Yeah, that was gold there.
Yeah, that was good.
I have to go very soon, but I wanted to ask you a few more questions unrelated to this. First of all, the exile.
Uh-huh.
Basically, I was going to ask you, is that the kind of journalism that, you know, you could ever see practiced here in the States? I mean, you have been, you know, you've received death threats, you have the Kremlin watching over you, you earned the wrath of I read a Baltimore Sun reporter who you played a prank on.
Yeah.
That was a very interesting story.
I had Representative Henry Bonilla last summer of Texas.
Uh-huh.
Last summer, he petitioned the State Department, officially.
Yeah.
To seek from the Russian government my arrest in Russia. And I wrote an article, you can read about it online. You can find his quotes where he was quoted also in the San Antonio Express calling for my arrest as well.
Wow.
Yeah, for a prank we played.
That's incredible.
And I talked to some State Department people and they said, yes, we got the request. No, nobody's going to act on it. You know, nobody's that, but you have to sort of humor it because he is a congressman. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And could we do that here? No, and I think it's because I think there are two reasons. We kind of work in a vacuum out in Russia. We got kind of lucky. I mean, it's a weird, perfect vacuum because on the one hand, we're not watched hugely closely by local authorities. They don't get us that much, right? We have a captive audience, which are local expats and even Russians who kind of like are looking for something different. And Russians love anything daring. Like, it's, as Lomonov always says, it's really, really hard to get a Russian's attention. Like, Lolita for them is already really boring. It's only Chikatilo's the only thing that interests them, or Basayev or something, you know? So you know, they like that. Whereas Americans, there's a lot of talk among Americans, especially young Americans, about liking independent thought, truly independent, daring, blah, blah, blah. And then when they see it, they want it shut down, you know, immediately. It's sort of like Rolling Stone magazine when they reviewed the first Velvet Underground album, they said that the First Amendment should not apply to these people. Yeah, you know. And then of course later he was like,
later it's acclaimed as a five-star masterpiece.
It's the number two album of all time. You know? And that's just how people are. I think that's how they are out here, and I don't think they're like that out there. And also, I think we got more kind of credibility. We're listened to more because we came from Russia. Then people here kind of think, well, there's some sort of credibility, or there's some other reason why I'll listen to them. But if they were in America, they'd find 100 reasons not to want to listen to us. You know what I mean? And then there's the other thing, which kills off most interesting stuff, I think, in this country, is could also just be ignored. I mean, that's the easiest way for people not to have to react to something that bothers them. You just ignore it, and it's like kryptonite. It just, you know, kills everything.
So you're saying that Russians don't ignore alternative venues as much as, say, Americans? Or?
Well, they're not as prude as we are. I don't know how else to put it. I mean, people on the left and right here are extremely prude, you know. I mean, I know not naming any names, like I ran into problems in getting on a particular show out here, when my little promotion thing, because I write about whores. And this is a left-wing, very sort of independent thought thing, but I read about prostitutes.
Just plain prostitutes.
Yeah, just prostitutes, and like even using the word whore already. And people just can't deal with that out here. Like, it's a huge, huge.
Well, it's sort of like William T. Volman, the great novelist here. He's the only novelist working in American Letters right now who is like, he's writing about whores, he's writing about junkies, crack cocaine. The real sort of downtrodden real people. And because of this, he has received such an incredible stigma And he keeps turning out book after book after book, and finally he just got nominated for the National Book Award. Well, the second time, but finally for his fiction. But it just goes to show you that if you, you know, that you, you know, 20 years of work before this guy even gets any kind of recognition for just, you know, everyday things like whores or anything like that.
Well, I haven't read his stuff, but he does sound really interesting. Some other people told me I should read him.
Yeah,
I
think you would like him.
I mean, the difference is I sleep with the whores and write about them, you know, their lives.
Like, well, he does too, actually.
Oh, yeah? Okay, good.
Yeah, he does.
Well,
he fictionalizes himself.
Oh, he fictionalizes himself. Okay.
Yeah. It's kind of like some of the stuff is
it like Uyebek kind of thing? Or
I'm sorry?
Like Uyebek's book Platform, is it kind of like that? Or
Somewhat. I mean, it's kind of, he's a very interesting hybrid between journalism and fiction, and sometimes he takes great liberties, and sometimes he's very autobiographical. I mean, he's written like, literally like, something like 20 books, and including a 7-volume set on the history of violence.
Yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah.
which is literally, you know, about 4,000 pages. I have it's a condensed version, though.
The Reader's Digest version.
Yeah, exactly.
That's interesting. I should read him. He sounds like a Graphoman or a speed freak, one of the two.
Yeah, well, but anyway.
So, I'm sorry, yeah, what's the...
To get the Chuck Klosterman thing out of the way. You know, of course, for those who haven't read, you wrote an infamous review in New York Press that you called Klosterman, you know, you weren't proud of this particular book, you weren't happy with this particular book, and you described Klosterman as his soft, sagging face bears a disturbing resemblance to a 50-year-old man's failing hairless back end. His tiny red mouth is a sphincter twisting to a pain close 40 seconds after taking a brutal pounding from Peter North. And some people, including Slate, actually, which said this was like the most adolescent sort of stab in any review whatsoever in 2003, seemed to think that you went too far. And I was wondering...
I don't know. I don't know how you can go too far with a book like that. I mean, you literally... I don't know if you've tried reading it.
I didn't, but I read this later.
I screeched out loud.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, I gave the last one because I couldn't... I had to do a review on it, but I literally couldn't read much of it, so I gave it to my girlfriend to read. She's Russian, and she started screeching, you know, in the other room. Like, we had to switch, yeah, we had to be in separate rooms, and I'd still hear her screaming, "Oh my God, how can he, this is sucks," you know, screeching out loud. It's like, it's real Guantanamo Bay stuff. I mean, it's just, yeah.
Did you ever read Klosterman's response to you in Zulky?
Some people send me something. What did he say?
He said, if the guy who wrote that article was smart or talented, he obviously wouldn't be working for the New York Press. That was his response.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
I mean, he's clearly hurt, and so his response is, I mean, his whole thing is all about like being edgy and, you know, a sort of a lonely loser kind of guy, and then his response is, well, I'm successful and he's not, you know, I'm big time and he's not. That's not really much of an argument, but I mean, it's sort of like saying Britney Spears is better than, you know, Bob Dylan or something, you know, because she sells more records. It's ridiculous. I don't know. I guess the only thing to do is to fight him if I see him. What else can you do? You know?
Really? Well, to set you up, we'll go ahead and create a pay-per-view event. Yeah. Mark Hughes versus Chuck Klosterman. You really fulfill the pledge of the
Well, he did. You know, he does. He really wants to get across in both books that he has this real macho, heterosexual, fighting man side to him.
He also pointed out that he's not particularly fond of exercise, but I'm athletic in the last book, you know.
Yeah, I think he pumped out a little bit between books. I'm sure my review had something to do with it, but he does. There is a part in the book where he writes about how some guy he knew wrote a nasty review of him in North Dakota, and then Chuck allegedly beats the shit out of him, and then they drink beers together afterwards and sort of.
Is this the My Nemesis character?
I can't remember. Right. I just remember.
In fact, actually, My Nemesis is there's a blog called Femuculus. Yeah, and that guy I think is actually my nemesis in this last book.
I see.
The whole he's bragging about he slept with his girlfriend. It's just like unbelievable. You know?
Good for him. That's good. Yeah, I mean, I was sent that book by the New York Press. What was it? 2 years ago.
Yeah.
To review the Cocoa Puffs one.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I was already reading some pretty bad books for them, and that one just was off the map. And I couldn't believe it, and it really brought out just violent thoughts, you know. And
well, so killing yourself to live did that for me. I couldn't believe this.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know what to say. The last one, you know, the second one was, it was also just so awful, but it was a bit of a letdown. I don't know, it didn't. it was horrible, but it didn't bother me as much as the first one. I guess because I knew what to expect already. I didn't know what to expect of the first one. And what's much more horrifying is that he really is capturing a popular voice.
Yeah, I know.
And that's what that's why it's like going after the Klosterman. It's like, you know, it's like taking out one insurgent, you know, without dealing with the bigger problem.
He's one big clusterfuck.
Exactly. I mean, he's really representative of something much bigger and much more horrible and successful too, and all the things, you know, that these guys co-opt everything that might potentially be interesting, like even just being a loser. The whole sort of idea of being a loser, you know, he's co-opting that and turning it into something cute and funny, and then just and making it harmless and getting rich off of it, or you know, and in being edgy or Sid Vicious or something, like all these things. They just, it's such a grotesque tendency in this country. You co-opt anything potentially dangerous, you make it completely harmless, you suck the life out of it, and then move on to something else. And I don't know what to say about Klosterman. Like, yeah, I want him to die, but you know, this is what I don't know if that would change much, because another Klosterman would pop up.
So inside you, there's like a rage murderer who would let loose and like Spin magazine.
yeah, it would be not. Good. I don't know. Just I'd prefer to fly a biplane over and just gas it or something. It doesn't have to be personal.
Mark Ames, thank you so much. I'll show you a specima.
Thank you too. And we have to like, does that come out through the microphone, the shaking of the hand there?
Well, I don't know. It's a logical sort of thing. It was a pleasure to talk with you.